beautiful passage in chapter 11 of Osi, in which in a divine soliloquy, God speaks and reflects upon his fatherhood of the people and how he carried them and brought them up to his cheek as one does with a young child, and how he tugged at them with the cords of love and with the ties of Adam, as the text goes, brought them along. And there are famous passages in Isaiah, the play on the Hebrew word rechem, which means womb, and rachum or rachum, which means mercy, both from the same root. Can a woman forget the child of her womb? No. And even if she could, I would never forget you, nor would I neglect to have mercy upon you. So nearly every love relationship has been enlisted within the biblical tradition to mediate this concept in this question of the experience of God.
We cannot really preconceive who's going to come through this and that and this. Now, when I was growing up, I don't think anyone thought or even had the least idea what would happen to me. I did, but we have preconceived ideas. Now, I'm jumping a bit. For instance, Valachi, or whatever they call him, the yellow bird that sang in Washington, the murder and culprit who shot.
Valachi.
Valachi.
You mean the gangster?
The gangster.
Who sang?
Now,
listening for a bird.
All right. No, they called him the yellow canary.
Yeah.
Now, for instance, I looked at his picture in the paper, and he had a face of nobility. They asked him how he murdered. He said, well, he murdered for money. Now, you take some of our big diplomats and big shots in Washington, from the president down, and they look like gangsters to me. So, you see, we have preconceived ideas of what this is and what this is, but we're going to have to shift and look at each one individually. So, where I identify, I really identify with myself.
You
with
see
it.
Yourself
with
in it. Others.
Yes, the same quality, mm-hmm. like a body of people. Mm-hmm. Now you say, does it give you more strength or not? I have the strength, they have the strength. It doesn't matter.
Thank you. What were some of the tunes they played out there?
Some of the tunes they played those days, well, they played a lot of rags, you know, the other band, well, not the Bell House band, but the maybe Imperial Superior band, they played a lot of rags, like Ophelia Rag, African Pass, Sunflower Rag, and so forth and so on, you know what I mean?
Sounds to me as if you like some room to move around in, a chance to maybe spread your wings and fly.
They'd be absolute. But men never get obsolete, and war doesn't seem they want to get obsolete. If we photograph everything, the simple little daily happenings, they might have been that contained the elements of premonition of what was going to happen. There's no way of foreseeing, of making a scenario about any military operation. But if you photograph the entire thing, if you photograph everything that happens, you've recorded history. And there is the unique weapon that the camera is in photographing the war.
Be out there and fight the good fight in every single home and be knocking on people's doors and trying to talk to them one-on-one. But, all we can hope for is to try our best, and if I can stop one or two...
Certainly.
I don't know. I'm a teacher, and I began as a teacher, and I read a lot of plays, and I have to teach a lot of plays. And I wouldn't say that there was one overriding influence. I never myself, until recently, liked Chekhov very much. I mean, I've only recently begun to appreciate him, but I certainly will accept the fact that this play has certain Chekhovian elements in the sense of a disintegrating world, the sense of erosion, the sense of kind of complicated tonality. Literary roots are very much Cheever, not simply in this play. I certainly lean on him in a way for which I am eternally indebted. And I'm very pleased that now, and in the past, say, 5 or 6 years, he's beginning to get his due.
Trouble, let's say, in your community where you live. I mean, somebody comes up to you, they think, boy,
you know,
there's a big, tough guy.
And everybody and I have are straight, okay?
That's only being an inch
now,
long.
Who needs to go get gay men? There's plenty of you and all y'all nodding y'all's head, but get your drunk, a six-pack, and you're dead meat.
But he can also lead us to what we seek, what the doctor calls the soul. It is time for our experiment to move into a final phase.
The mural, the canvas, becomes a field of action in which the artist makes his gestures.
One has no conception of looking at the finished works. The madness and risk and nerve and being on the edge of an abyss, it seems to oneself when one's actually making them. Though they seem perfectly serene and ordered after they're done. And I think all of my generation, or certainly most of my generation, to a great extent, experienced it as such.
Pollock is still taken for this example of far-outism. The people who admire him most on the New York scene today don't take him as a painter. They take him as an example of the a successor, an artist in the line of Duchamp, someone who knocked you flat with his arbitrariness.
Realize you don't take a stand pro or con at legalization, but at worst it's a minor misdemeanor, and you find that tens of thousands of people are suffering away in jails with extreme penalties for this. People even lose their property for growing a little.
That's true.
And these laws come from Congress, and I was wondering if you could address the question of how this can be changed or moderated, and how the marijuana prisoners can be freed.
Well, of course, the Schaefer Commission, which was appointed by Nixon, recommended decriminalization of marijuana, as did the commissions appointed by Ford and Carter. Then Reagan came in you know, a new broom sweeps clean, he brought a bulldozer into the scene. So all I can say is in the period during the 70s, something like 23 states decriminalized. The last was Alaska. Actually, it was in 1982. It was their second act of decriminalization. Possession of 4 ounces or less in the privacy of your own home is legal in Alaska. I called the Attorney General. I didn't put this in the book. I don't know why. There's a lot, you know, just space requirements. I called the Attorney General of Alaska and the Public Defender's Office to find out if there had been any difference before or after, and there was apparently none. I don't assume there's any difference in terms of use and abuse when marijuana was legal, which was before 1937, and now.
Same. American policy of the Reagan administration. But part of the imperialization is that when a demonstration happens, if locals build it, then Pacifica may ask, maybe ask your station to cover it. But I don't know whether will they provide funding, though, or share some of the funds that they do get to provide local coverage before it happens, to help build it, so that people from New York will know about it and then come up to the demonstration. And that's what advocacy is. If free speech is more than just when the event happens. It's getting on, being able to...
Frank Pantangeli came to my home, and he asked my permission to get rid of the Rosado brothers. Secret of change is X equals 3.
Creator might be a better way to view it.
But now wait a minute. Now you're saying that the device was here before Jesus walked on Earth.
Yes.
Before God destroyed people on the Earth, he warned Gordon to the act.
I will set you right.
Not the world, not the act. I believe it told not to warn the people. They must change that the wicked fear before he come upon them and destroy them. Some boy began to really suck.
Reputable people performing careful experiments with careful controls.
Paul's phenomenon is a kind of symptomatic one in that his position is based on certain idea of art history, an idea of art history that the museum collecting, criticism, the art market is all geared to, and that is what we might call the heroism of the big breakthrough.
People performing careful experiments with careful controls who seem to give evidence just of the sort that you've described.
Equals three. And the secret of change is a mouse spinning. Well, that must be profound, because I can't figure out what in the world that means. It means nothing. Change is instant. Yeah, I can grab a hold of that. And stop waiting for it. Stop watching for it. Stop wondering why I don't feel it, why I don't see it.
To me says that the others, if you will, were here before the Son of Christ, before the word was given that God was even up there. I mean, we have the tablets and the commandments and all the rest of that. So the aliens were here before the Creator fellow.
Okay, external world. Thank you.
suppose when you're talking about the creator failure, in this instance, we're talking about the agent of the creator.
And I appreciate that TLC, Kentino Wally. Reality, no folly. Bomb it up, y'all.
To do with it, and it's a funny kind of a question. How, you know, how do you think the country is doing? I mean, don't we tend to sort of think that you mean what's wrong with the country? Doesn't that question imply?
Well, I think I think the better question is how is your country doing? When I did the piece on this a couple of years ago, I went out and I talked with different kinds of people. I spent some time with World War II veterans who had one perspective. I spent a fascinating hour and a half with teenage boys who are just about to leave high school and go off to college. Reality, no for them kids of far vanity, and they don't have no love for humanity. But if I so you are think that it's so big, you better try.
You must be aware of these things. They are fashions in the intellectual world. On the other hand, if you feel warm-hearted towards the universe, you put it up instead of putting it down, and you say about rocks, they're really conscious, but a very primitive form of consciousness. Because after all, when I take even this crystal here, which is glass, and go, well, it makes a noise. And that response, that resonance, is an extremely primitive form of consciousness. I'm a music maker, Canada, England, America and Jamaica. They might all love the falling, you know, one reality. Hey, guys, the falling, you know, one reality. I love the falling, you know, one reality. Hey, guys, the falling, you know, one reality. Each and every man have a right to be free and to decide.
Okay. In the Sumerian tradition, his name was Enki. The Egyptians called him Osiris. And these, when you do the research on the early Christian stories in the Old Testament, the book of Genesis,
right,
where that's derived from, it's derived from streams that originated in Sumeria, in Egypt, and in India. So we have to go back to that prehistory in order to pick up this story, because that's where we find depictions and stories of this device, and we see it being carted around the ancient world and being placed at certain locations at very specific times for the purpose of channeling through or bringing through this Christ soul.
Was a very intense personality, but he wasn't a great artist. His work, like the work of all the New York School, is based on, well, to put it inelegantly, a kind of mopping up operation of the School of Paris.
The impact on the awareness of the American people, and at that time, there will be an attack on the CIA.
I can understand what change is and that is happening in my future, and stop looking to my past. But start creating it. Doesn't matter what I was. What matters is what I am and becoming. And things in my past that I do want to change, because they're haunting me, because they're bothering me, because I don't want to just walk around with all that garbage. Ching, 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 chank it around with me like chains and balls and things of this sort dragging behind me. I want to cut that past free. Where I do that, certainly so, is go back into it to understand it, but then to reach into the future to change it. so that it happens now, and that it is an art, and therefore I don't have to know everything, just enough, and rely upon and use my subconscious unconscious, that I can harness and direct it.
Not just to change and see what happens, not to spin of a wheel and hope it lands where I want.
But I can weigh the roulette table and that same thing so that it lands where I want it to, by directing it, by harnessing it, not by manipulating or controlling it.
Consciousness is much more subtle than that. But when you hit a bell and it rings, you touch a crystal and it responds, inside itself, it has a very simple reaction. It goes jangle inside, whereas we go jangle with all sorts of colors and lights and intelligent ideas and thoughts. It's more complicated.
I don't know how many years. And of course I'm an outsider. Complete outsider. It's chance that I came here, that Gertrude Stein suggested it.
Communist tyranny, without the God-given rights of freedom and human dignity.
Cheever has an element of mystery in all his stories. And a kind of a mythological overtone. Somehow he always kind of plugs in on fables. I mean, behind the most ostensibly suburban yarn, there are always kind of Greek overtones. I mean, Diana bathing and Actaeon being torn apart by hounds and all that. I mean, and he kind of lifts the curtain on that a little bit, but he doesn't spell it out. I mean, it's subtle and... Now, what I've tried to do to somewhat achieve it is, again, work somehow with offstage characters or offstage events or offstage life, for example, in the dining room. Because I do think, I feel very strongly that the theater requires, needs, it has to have that kind of resonance, that kind of mystery at its perimeters.
what's in a novel is not important to me. It's how it's told, how the words go together, what makes a good sentence. But that's, after all, there's nothing in writing except words. Invention of sympathetic characters, the invention of fascinating plots. I don't think that counts. Really. It may count with the big public. I'm sure it does. Yes. But it doesn't count with me. I'm just one person, but I do write these books. And what counts with me is the language.
I considered myself a good spy. I would be given a name of a student or a professor or a teaching assistant, and I would try to develop a relationship with this person and try to get them to say to me statements concerning U.S. involvement in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. I was to infiltrate student groups to get copies of propaganda, meeting times, protest posters, this kind of thing.
You're friendly spy on campus. We could switch around and use it as foresight, but in hindsight, yeah, if I could go back and change things, I'd have to go back 30 years to 1965 in my senior year and refuse the offer that was made to me by the CIA and take my chances with the draft and have pursued my engineering career. It certainly would have been a better life than what I had. I wouldn't have the memories that I have of the things that I've done to people and countries, and all of it in the name of the United States.
But both are equally conscious, but conscious in different degrees. And yet underneath to be identical.
With by nearly everyone else. And not just a clown, that's not true, but like a novelty. I found a lot more rapport with their ideas about what art was than I did with a lot of of painters. Theater has a lot more to do with action, the way it's the way theater is lived, than the popular idea going on at that time about action painting.
What makes you believe that he, who was here 2,000 years ago, will be returning this summer?
Well, Nostradamus left his very specific quatrain in which he said in July of 1999.
People, in trying to give a word dimension to this experience, look to various facets of human life and call upon them in order to mediate that part of the experience which can have an intelligible content. Now, it's true that over 50% of the mystical literature relies upon the world of the love between a man and a woman. In this human experience, most mystics move. Well, I think the reason for that is that there is no other human experience which can be so totally absorbing, so powerful, and so tender all at the same time.
The hammer was in his right hand, the nail in his left. "Milly diddle din," he said quite loud, putting the point of the nail as far into Tammy's ear as he could. He raised his right arm and hit the head of the nail with all his might. He laid the hammer down and felt of the nail head.
People accuse me of being a violent writer. It's completely false, of course. The fact that I might have written four or five stories in which violence occurs does not make me a writer about violence, because I've written more than 50 stories, so that leaves, 45 stories which are not violent. They pick out the works in which they can prove it. Short stories like The Delicate Prey, A Distant Episode, but they're always being anthologized over and over and over, year after year. Those two.
Shunyata. Now, shunyata is the Sanskrit for nothingness, and it's supposed to be the ultimate reality. But as you know, if you know anything about these doctrines, this doesn't mean real nothingness, not kind of just nothing there at all, not just blank, but it means no thingness. It's the transcendental reality behind all separate and individual things, and that's something very deep and profound.
There's nothing to do about it, you know.
You and I had this conversation
just about 20 months ago. And maybe I'm just a jerk, but I actually believed you really wanted to get off it.
Yeah, I do.
That if I would take my life, that I would leave a couple people behind very hurt. And I don't believe that I want to do that. If I just had one wish, I would wish that I can successfully beat this drug. Because there's really not too much left to my life.
Yeah, maybe get...
out of the sky, resurrect the king of the Mongols. The reason that I believe that this is this figure is because when this device was brought first to America, one of its locations where it was housed was in Mexico, which was then considered part of America. I mean, the whole North American continent was
sure.
America.
Sure.
And in fact, when we signed NAFTA in 94, we reunited America with Mexico, so we became one once again. This pillar was taken to a place called Tula in Mexico. Tula is a very powerful word for us. It's going to enable us to open up many of these myths. And indeed, what we find in the Mayan tradition is the belief that their ancestors came from Atula in the central point in heaven, which was their homeland, but that these people who came from Tula also lived in Mongolia previous to coming to Mexico.
All right, well,
the mission of this peacemaker or king of terror centers around the Sphinx, which in the Arab tradition was called the father of terror.
I hear half an hour in air, but it's not a real sleep. It's not like a full cycle.
Tell me about the last 8 days. Tell me about...
Wait, you want to know what I've gone through?
I want to know what you're going through. Right now. Tell me how you feel right now.
Well, I'm withdrawing from home. And what I'm going through is... what happens is, there's a lot of emotional and physical pain for the first 3 days. And you don't sleep for about 10 days, sometimes 12 days. It's a real tough thing. It's real hard to explain. It's real hard for me to make somebody feel what I feel when I'm, from a hell and deep.
That's why I'm asking you. Yeah. Right now, you're cold.
Yeah.
All right, we're sitting outside. It's not terribly warm, but you were cold inside too.
You're right. Yeah, you feel very cold. You know, I feel warmer today than I would have been, on the third day to detox.
Headache?
Yeah. Haven't slept, get a headache, your muscles ache, your back hurts. You hurt. You hurt emotionally, you hurt physically, you hurt so bad. It's the most god-awful thing. I wouldn't want anybody to have to go through this. It's like you want to run around the block, but you can't get off the couch or get off the floor, You vomit for a couple days, and your body just goes nuts. Your mind just goes crazy. You just have no control over it. There's nothing you can do about it,
You and I had this conversation just about 20 months ago. And maybe I'm just a jerk, but I actually believed you really wanted to get off it.
Yeah, I do. I do. I can't find a way out. It's been a constant cycle since this thing even started, when it started in the first place 6 years ago. It's just cycling. I get clean for a while, maybe months, 6 weeks, and I'm back out using drugs again.
Where does the problem come? You're telling me you're off heroin now for 8 days.
Right.
Right?
The problem comes when I start feeling healthy again in about 3 or 4 weeks and start feeling confident. Maybe I get cocky or something, I don't know. As soon as I start getting money in my pocket or something like that, and I go back to work, it becomes difficult for me because the obsessions start to kick in. I get so excited that I can throw up.
So excited what? At the thought of having heroin?
The thought of getting high, yeah.
That they smoke an awful lot and that their perceptions are much different than everybody else's perceptions. But I think if you break the society down into different groups, you get different perspectives on how things are. I think really it's the only way to approach the question, because when you start making things into these giant cauldrons of soup, reality gets lost.
I would also add that if you ask people more specifically about whether they think particular things in American life are in decline or whether they're progressing, you get the same kind of response. People think that the elderly are more likely to be poor. They think all sorts of problems are getting worse in the country, homelessness, race relations. It just goes on and on. And many of these things are demonstrably getting better. Violent crime is a perfect example. Most Americans still think that violent crime is rising, and it's really dropped through the floor in the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, that's one of the things, and Charles had pointed to the notion that the media is somehow responsible for this, and yet in some ways, because we have more television, there's more stuff, more information available, why aren't we better aware of the fact that these problems are actually improving?
Well, I think there is a kind of bias and prejudice in the media, not just in television, but in all sorts of media, to report sort of what I would describe in the book as a kind of iron cycle of alarmism. It's very rare that you ever hear good news in a sustained way, certainly on television, but in other forms of media too. There's this old journalism adage that if there are 1,000 houses in a neighborhood and one of them burns down, the next day's story is about the one that burned down, not about the 999 that are marvels of modern day construction.
Gather certain remnants of cubism, surrealism, and attempts to charge them with another kind of energy, which in turn requires a larger format and a bigger gesture, because something is being drawn to an end. I see the whole abstract expressionist phenomenon, and Pollock in particular, as a kind of last gasp of modern European modernism.
From getting into this, I think I've done my job.
Paul Capelli, thank you for talking with us, sir.
Thank you very much.
Paul Capelli is the president of the Ad Store in Manhattan and the creative director for some of the ads in the new federal anti-drug ad campaign.
And there, but I had shot her in the head. And then when I realized what I did, you know, I said, my God, you know. I mean, it happened so fast, I never even knew what I did. After what happened, it was like a nightmare.
Yes, that's just one link in this, but the real reason why he's called the King of Terror, the story really picks up around 700 A.D. We have what's something called the Frank's Casket, which was discovered in Germany, and it shows the adoration of the Magi. And this is, of course, the three wise men surrounding the Christ child. And
yes.
There's a runic inscription around the edge of the box that says, "The fish beat up the sea. The King of Terror, Jesus, became sad when he swam upon the shingle." And the shingle is thought to be the earth. In 770 A.D., in the first recorded Holy Grail legend, Jesus appeared to a young Frenchman and dictated a book to him, which he called, "Here Commences the First Telling of the Holy Grail." The first chapter of that book was, "Here Commences Terror." So from that moment forward, at least in southern France where Nostradamus lived, Jesus, terror, the Holy Grail, and also enlightenment were linked, because as soon as the young Frenchman looked into that book, the Grail, he was instantly terrified by what he saw.
And it's magic. Therefore I can allow it. And I can be healed. Because I can look at myself and say, look at all these changes that didn't happen. Bad me. Evil me. Sinful me. Hurting you. You don't need more discipline or admonishment. More love. More healing. And when I'm healed, I can change with the, quote, best of them. Unquote. I don't have to catch up, nor make up, nor vindicate for all the times while ill I didn't change.
The problem, I think, with the media, where it's gotten even worse, and I particularly blame television for this, is that the coverage on television has gotten even more slanted, I think, in the last decade, particularly the coverage of violent crime. The amount of coverage of homicides, for example, on the national news has gone up over 400% since the early 1990s. Now, the actual...
on a daily basis.
They are about 9 years.
And I'm excluding, when I give those numbers, I'm excluding any stories in O.J. Simpson. So this is really a mind-boggling increase in coverage at a time where this problem is getting quite a bit better.
Yep.
A man named Jibari gave a thesis to the Sorbonne, and he entitled it The Life and Works of Paul Bowles, and he was rejected. Then a little later, without changing the thesis at all, he gave it a new title, which was L'horreur et la violence dans l'œuvre de Paul Bowles. Horror and violence in the works of Paul Bowles. Immediately he was accepted.
Otherwise it seems flat and obvious and dead. Somehow it's got to vibrate with something beyond itself. It's very hard for a writer to suddenly say, now in this play I'm going to get deep. the material occurs to you. You find yourself writing something and it begins to go in another direction.
You actually got an offer based on someone seeing you on Nightline.
Right.
To go down to
what? Get treatment.
To get treatment in Florida, right?
Right.
You went down, you got the treatment.
Right.
You were down there how long?
About 6 weeks.
And?
Came back home, two weeks, had a job, got high. You know? Even though, this thing has affected me for the rest of my life. If I stay clean for the next 20 years, it's done its job. It's affected me, and it would always have left this scar.
Now, during that period, you and I were talking on the phone.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You were telling me you were off drugs.
I would only talk to you when I was. That was the only time I was comfortable talking to you. So when you hear from me, I was clean. When you don't hear from me, I'm using.
Acting is always reacting and mostly listening. I mean, you notice that if you watch, what's so interesting about these talk shows is the way that people listen to the questions. Everybody sees themselves as a person listening in life. And almost afraid to speak. Identification comes with the passive. Not the acting. That's not too hard to do if you just forget about yourself. That's very hard to do.
WZBC. Out of Newton. New Metaphysics, Gary Geiserman. 90.3. Oh, and one more thing. 552-4686. Is there any other reason to speak? I thought not.
Yeah. And that's what was so interesting in working with Jack, because like I said, his reasons for not wanting to do it the same each time are his own. And that's very interesting to examine, but I don't want to do that in, you know, public. All I know is being on the other end of it, you have to react spontaneously. He doesn't let you get away with having anything planned. because you're going to get screwed if you do. It's going to be so uneven.
The way people are, they want that.
I think, David, that if you look closely at that, you see that there's economics behind it, because it's much easier if you're running a news operation. And I've done this at UPI and other places. It's much easier if you're running a news operation to go for those events that happen that are easily described than it is to sit down and try to put some time and money against perhaps broader themes. And I have to mention at this point an experience that I had in Gettysburg, of all places, a couple years ago, where I decided to watch nothing but the TV that came into the town of Gettysburg, which has a very small black population, and most of the TV was from Baltimore and Washington and some from Philadelphia, and predominantly it focused on black-on-black crime. And I began to wonder what the people in Gettysburg, particularly the children, what their perceptions of black America would become watching news from those channels. And I think that happens on a much larger scale across the country. It's what media chooses to pay attention to that defines people's perceptions of reality. And that puts a pretty large burden on us to be a little more responsible about what we're looking at and how we're describing it.
Let's flag.
For many years, I didn't even tell my friends I worked for CIA because I was embarrassed. It's colored my life. It always will. It's like a shadow that falls over my life all the time. If I say anything against them, I turn around wondering if I'm being followed. I never even thought of joining the CIA. First of all, I thought I probably couldn't get in because it was considered the Cadillac of government agencies. And they mostly hired from Ivy League colleges. And I was just out of high school, went right to work for Veterans Administration. And actually, it was the typewriter repairman came in to repair my typewriter one day. And he said, you know, you shouldn't be working here. You should be working at a nicer place.
Character. Who is this character?
She is a woman who is intent on creating chaos, I think, to find the truth and find the collective truth for the group as well as for herself.
Who are the group?
The group is a family in Savannah, Georgia. My mother, my sister, who is going to be married, her marriage I tried to sabotage with the intention of creating chaos.
To create chaos in order to achieve what?
Truth.
Truth. From chaos comes truth.
I think so. From chaos comes clarity, at least. Hopefully resolution.
With a mother here, because that I don't go with. You, we had problems with an Oconomowoc. We had to get somebody else to. I'll point at you if I want to.
I'll point at you.
You take me off, I'm going to have to get up and knock your ass flat on the stage.
They test you a lot. Huge testing. I mean, when you're put into this personnel pool, there's, there are probably 2 or 3 weeks of tests where it's all day long, every single day. and their IQ tests, their personality tests. The questions that bothered me the most was when I took the polygraph test. And the polygraph test, they ask you such incredibly personal questions. For instance, they asked me if I was a virgin. And I was 18. And I thought, what business is it of theirs whether I am or not? And I was rather embarrassed to tell them that I was.
Has always had a great reputation among writers as a writer's writer, elite writer, caviar writer, one whose lineage goes back to Gertrude Stein, which is the grand lineage of the 20th century in American poetry.
I've always felt an outsider, even in my family. My parents made me feel that I was an outsider, that I wasn't part of them. Why, I don't know. Perhaps they didn't want a child. It goes without saying that members of the same family all hate each other and fight all the time. And if there's a child there, the child knows it too. It doesn't matter how small he is. He realizes that it'd be better if he weren't there.
Well, you know what I find that's really amazing about performing on stage that I love the most, really, is the character becomes so unconscious once you get to actually do a performance many, many times. It becomes a certain unconsciousness comes into play that it's impossible for that to happen for me. In a short run, and it's almost impossible for it to happen for me in a movie. Movies, the rhythm is so different. You never lose yourself. In a play, it's like you can actually feel somewhat altered by the experience of doing it repeatedly.
Healed now. Letting those in gravitationally from the seventh chakra down to the first. Then they're your secrets. Beyond the secrets, technique. Four techniques of change. The first technique is to engage the subconscious mind. Now, we talked about this last month as we talked about new tools also to engage the subconscious mind, to work with it, to understand it, to let it heal and clear what's in the way, the resistances, etc. Tonight, as we talk about it in greater detail. To engage the subconscious mind, produce change. First, it is important to figure out what your subconscious mind is going to look like. Now, that's totally up to you. You cannot be wrong.
Right.
You cannot be wrong. Whatever you want it to look like, whatever you think it should look like, whatever in your gut seems right, is right. Because subconscious is subjective. And therefore, you can't be wrong. If you think, as we've used some analogies, you think it should look like a maze, a labyrinth of some sort, fine, then it will. If you think it should be a high-tech maze with glass and mirrors and chrome, fine. If
Do you think it should be a medieval maze or labyrinth in some stone walls and moss hanging in dripping water and all this kind of thing? Then great, if you think that's what it should look like. If you're a Trekkie and think it should look like the Admiral's chair in the Star Trek ship Enterprise or whatever, with all kinds of, people around doing work and screens and buttons and beam me up, Scotty kind of thing, fine. If you're more technically oriented and more soberly oriented, perhaps, think it should look like a computer center with all kinds of computers and clickety-clack and all kinds of work people around with white coats and horn-rimmed glasses and flickering fluorescent lights on white linoleum floors, fine. That's fine. If you think it should look like a huge house with all kinds of nooks and crannies and rooms, wonderful. If you think it should be some sort of basement, we have to go down a spiral or a straight staircase down into the depth because that seems more great. Do you think it should be a huge warehouse filled with corrugated boxes and wooden boxes sealed with all that funny sort of straw in that way, containing all the stuff of your... If you think it should be like a library, a huge ancient library with books for floors upon floor with cobwebs and little sort of study kettles and this sort of thing, grand. You decide. Do you think it should be outdoors somewhere, a huge meadow, a huge plain? Fine. Because it's all yours, you can, and the reason you'll decide is because that's the way it is for you. Now, we've talked of it in terms of in the death experience when people die. They find heaven to be exactly what they thought it would be. And it's grand and it's wonderful. And certain people, when they die, have to go to the edge of hell, They have to go right up to the edge of it. A lot of fundamentalists do this, Because all their life, they're sure, if they don't behave, if they don't, keep their nose clean, as it were, that they're going to go to hell. And so they die, and they go right up to the edge, and whoa, they teeter and they totter. But they never go in. No one ever has. There's no hell. There's only an edge of hell. Fixed in the mix, and I couldn't stand still. So I went AWOL, but it wasn't my will. Girlfriend smoked out, and her lies burnt out. Losing weight, and her legs, and her stomach sticking out. Knowing daddy's uptown, and it's worth going around. Keep your head to the ground, and your soul heaven bound. Now ain't no use in screaming loud, cause your money's gone off chasing clouds. Leaving you once again to pick up slack. But wait, yo, going is where yo at. Concentrate! You got to think a little harder. Come here, let me show you before you even start to. On the big payday! Yeah. Concentrate! You got to think a little harder. Come here, let me show you before you even start to. Playing with fire. Don't you know that you're gonna get lit? What she say, trying to hit the jackpot. Brother man swearing what a year's a year's not. Landlord smiling and my motor's not hot. Pretty little sister should be kept in a cage. She thinks she's grown up cause she looks older than her age. She shows the streets over a chance on stage. Found dead in the river, story made the first page. Devil snatched his souls into a little glass beam, saying if you got problems I can change your whole scene. It's not as easy as it surely may seem. You lose your life but with the price of a dream.
Your mind, first step to your heart, and nothing will work if something don't start. No meat on my plate cause I choose my own fate. My people's moving out at a very high rate, either to the grave or way upstate. I better concentrate. You got to think a little harder. Come here, let me show you before you even start to woke up one morning after a nightmare. Heart full of fear, oh darling, my dear. My man's got it all and don't want to share. No clothes on my back, now I swear.
That's all the further you could go, isn't it? Well, I'm sure all those other people fell in, but I...
He knows that when the teacher said, I have nothing to teach, he meant this very esoteric no thing. Well, he might also say, then, if you have nothing to teach, what are all these students doing around here?
I'm looking at my mother and father dead, my sister. I said, my God, I got scared. I ran out of the house. Ran down the street, ran out of the house, jumped in my car, ran down the street, and got my friends and came back to the house. They all went in the house. I stood outside now.
During this whole time, he told us that he had a dog. The dog in the house was going crazy. And it, unfortunately, no one had ever heard the dog nor any of the noises except Ronnie DeFeo.
Good old Ronnie DeFeo had to go and pick up a syringe and get some more heroin.
Those processes do exist to varying extents in all news media. But
varying extents, depending on where you are.
Exactly. But in this environment where there is such corporate pressure, where there is a breakdown between journalism and entertainment in some cases, or a confusion, we do need the public to be a part of the process. We do need them to think critically of what they're reading and to ask the kinds of questions that...
Pollock's paintings live or die in the same context that Rembrandt's or Titian's or Velasquez. There's no interruption. There's no mutation here. Pollock has to be tested by the same eye that can see how good Raphael was when he was good.
I don't think any of my girlfriends were. I was raised very strict. There were very few women at CIA who were other than secretaries. It was very sexist. It was the male establishment, the white male establishment. I asked a couple of times why it was that there were no blacks there and why there were no gay people there, although they didn't call them gays in that time, in those days. I think they called them queers in those days. And they said because homosexuals could not be cleared because they could be blackmailed. They said that blacks couldn't be cleared because blacks just weren't, they were just still too primitive. They just weren't usually smart enough. And they didn't have the kind of background that white people had. I mean, I didn't think that much at the time because it was like sort of standard operating procedure. But when I think about it now, I'm really quite shocked how you probably would never get a job if you were black. I was assigned as a secretary in the audio surveillance division. They were experts on listening devices and hidden microphones and that sort of thing. I did also very often help the operatives get their... The documents that they needed. Once in a while, I'd have to make a quick trip to State Department to pick up their passports. And sometimes, if we couldn't get the passports in time, then I'd have to go over to Graphic Arts Reproduction Division so that they could forge one for them. Most of them were artists in there, but they were recruited from prisons because they were forgers, and they were master forgers. They were people who knew how to forge money. And they forged all kinds of things. That's how they made their living.
going to the companies and saying, look, now you don't have a competitive advantage by having something which is, now that everybody has this, let's decide on a way that we'll do it all together. So that we can build on this, so that instead of fighting about exactly how we'll do it and having these incompatibilities which reduce the power of the whole system, let's decide that this is a done deal now. We know that we can do this. Let's do it in a standard way, and let's release that as public specification so that anybody can do it that way. And then let's go on and invent the next thing. Let's go on and look at all the exciting things we can do using that new feature.
I agree with you totally, Charles, and I think it's particularly important because local news is watched much more than it once was.
And trusted.
Yeah. And trusted. And if you look at the amount of coverage, for example, that local television news devotes to education and the environment versus what it devotes to crime, there's absolutely no comparison. The education in a given night may be 2% of the stories, crime may be 25%. Mm-hmm.
Why is it, though, that, and maybe this is almost too broad a question to try to answer, but I think it's central to what you're talking about. Why are we so attracted to this kind of news? If all we want to do is be happy, why are we so happy with other people's affliction?
Part of it is that the people who are making the news all have a vested interest in talking about afflictions. I mean, if you go back to the issue of the environment, for example, who makes news in environmental coverage? Well, there's environmental advocacy groups who are not going to trumpet the fact that the air is much cleaner today than it was 25 years ago and that they've had all sorts of successes in Congress. At the same time, the National Association of Manufacturers is also not issuing press releases that praise Congress for introducing new regulation that reduced hydrofluorocarbons in the atmosphere or something of that sort. And the same thing is true of the media. We again, are not, by and large, purveyors of good news. There was a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago where they tried to track a couple of publications and what happened to them that were really intent on publishing good news and sort of spreading the gospel of optimism. And these publications were having enormous difficulty attracting readers, and they were really, most of them were kind of going under.
So as soon as I could, I got away without even telling him. I just escaped and went to Paris, where I was another kind of outsider, not so intimate and not so painful. Then I got so that I liked the idea of being an outsider, so I've always been one since.
Terry Labonte hung out on the inside. Here comes Jeff Gordon and Kenny Wallace.
Good run for Kenny Wallace, who also had a good pit stop to put him up here in the lead draft. Checking the speeds at the line. Look, Kenny was the fastest that lap.
That's because he was catching the draft down on the bottom of the racetrack. 196 mile per hour average.
Second was Ward Burton. Derek Cope was third with that pass lap.
Now to get caught up with the field and get to these other cars, they will slow down to the same speed the other cars are running.
Kenny working to the inside of Sterling Marlin, drafting on Jeff Gordon, who is drafting on Mark Martin. Now Jeff gets hung out a bit.
He did not think of himself as a tourist. He was a traveler. The difference is partly one of time. Whereas the tourist generally hurries back home at the end of a few weeks or months, the traveler, belonging no more to one place than the next, moves slowly over periods of years from one part of the earth to another.
Comprised of rectangular objects.
Indeed, he would have found it difficult to tell, among the many places he had lived, precisely where it was he felt most at home.
Outside, and he dove it. Dennis Setzer, the dark car on the inside, our second round fastest qualifier. Our leader, Bobby Labonte.
This is the third car from the Bill Elliott stable. Besides Elliott, Elliott co-owns the 13 car driven by Jerry Nadeau with Dan Marino. And this third car was driven this weekend by Dennis Setzer.
Then he achieved enlightenment. And as many of us, if we think back on our own spiritual paths...
What is the terrifying thing that he saw?
That puzzled me for a long, long time. It's always described as a bright white light.
You know,
you just
it's
come to it
like,
some way that you don't know.
It's like free association. You know, you are so comfortable with yourself in the play, with the character, with the other characters, that it becomes kind of free associative, where there's another life that you would never anticipate, you could never hope for. You can't create it. It just comes from repetition. It comes from a history.
I'm more or less ashamed of myself. You know, I don't. When I start using, it's probably one of my. What takes me so long to come out of it is because I don't tell anybody, and I hide it. You know, and I bob and I weave and I try to get around what's going on, what's really going on. My feelings inside are telling me, in a month, I'm going to get out, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to fall again, because. Every time I get sick and I say, oh, I'm never going to do this again, I really believe what I'm saying, and the next thing you know, I start feeling okay, and I start getting some money in my pocket, and it's all over.
I don't think a person just grows up bad, you know what I'm saying? He eventually gets that way from being around somebody that is like that. But so, yeah, at first I was like one of those statistics, little punk big glasses. Yeah, but I never did wear glasses, but you know what I'm saying? I was a coward back then, you know what I'm saying? So I ran home from school, got chased and stuff like that until the point, you know, I say I had... got tired of my brothers beating up on me, and you know what I'm saying, I had to fend for myself, and then I took it out on the bully. So when little did I know, I had a little bit more than the bully had. So you know, I beat him up, and then, you know what I'm saying, everybody be around watching, they be like, oh man, you see him, he beat him up, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, yeah, okay, I got that rep now, you know what I'm saying, that reputation, I'm the bad guy. So you know, I ain't gotta worry about getting chased no more.
Great, but you know, the profit motive is really strong. What authority do you have to tell a company that, no, you should really do something universal?
We have no authority at all. However, this is a win-win situation that we have to rely on the fact that being incompatible is no fun for any company. It's a very bad mark to be incompatible with the standards. It's a very bad mark to have people to say, please don't use this particular browser on this page because it really won't work properly. moments. And so, in fact, what happens is that when the moment it's not it's not really, really the leading edge of what they feel is then the most exciting feature for the next version, companies are quite happy to sit around the table, and there are a number of draft specifications which we've released recently which illustrate that.
So the World Wide Web Consortium has basically the power of persuasion. is that the power that you have to regulate the web?
That's right. We're funded by our members, by those companies that we're trying to persuade. So we feel that if they didn't want us to persuade them, they wouldn't have started the consortium in the first place.
So you feel that everybody has a vested financial interest in keeping the web open, and that's one of the things that's going to allow the web to stay open?
Yes, in the end, because the web itself is not, in fact, it's not the end of all things. The web is a means. The web is an exciting information space. We're developing it to make it richer. But what's interesting is what you do with it. What is interesting are the programs that you have on the clever clients, the clever servers, the totally new applications, when you start doing financial transactions across the internet, when you start seeing three-dimensional things, when you have beautiful educational worlds, that all the applications that you produce on top of that will be enabled by the richness of the web and by the way it interoperates. If a company tries to go out by itself and be separate and be individual and not interoperate with the rest of the world, then unless they can corner the entire market and persuade everybody who's buying software and buying information that that's a good idea, then they'll look very silly if, in fact, the rest of the world gets together and decides to do it in a common way.
As we've said before, you decided not to patent the programs or the software that you came up with to create the World Wide Web. But now that the World Wide Web exists, everybody's trying to make money from it. And, you know, more and more people are entering the web in the hopes that if not now, tomorrow, they'll be able to make a buck. What do you think of the growing commercialization within the web?
What do you mean by that? You mean advertising sites?
Exactly. More and more advertising sites, more and more people trying to use the web to sell things.
Also supposed to be asking of individual stories.
Betty Metzger, we're rapidly approaching the end of this hour. We've been talking ethics here. What can you kind of sum up? What's needed here? More scrutiny? More classes in ethics? Different personality tests?
Well, there are a lot of things needed, but Jeffrey mentioned the fact that the churn is good. I think that one good thing that could come and should come from the churn is getting rid of the attitude in newsrooms that ethics, the study of ethics, gets in our way, which has been an attitude among particularly managers at times. I've heard it expressed. And another thing that would be good would be if journalism schools could connect to the profession more. And
bandwidth, like what is contemplated with At Home. But if high bandwidth becomes generally available, and if it becomes cost-effective, you can imagine all sorts of incredible customer experiences that you can create in an e-commerce environment. I mean, just to give you one example, we could have every author have a short, you know, five-minute instructional video on why you should buy my book, and you know how it will help you and what it's about. And then you could send you can send email to authors. We invite every author to put their email address in the catalog, and many of them do that. They love to hear from their readers.
The first play I did was with Joe Losey. And it was to raise money for Republican Spain. Then I went on to Orson Welles. Then I went on to a whole lot of other people. I wrote four scores for Tennessee Williams plays. And I wrote for Jose Ferrer. And I wrote a ballet with Salvador Dali.
One day he played me a tape, or acetate as they were called in those days, of a broadcast of an aria from his opera, The Wind Remains, the effect of which I found so contagious that I'm not yet over the delicious illness that it caused me. a five-minute aria that was based on simply three notes, or the dying fall. It's a minor third descending. That's a descending minor third, and a great deal of excruciatingly touching music has been built simply on that. And in the case of the end of the aria in The Wind Remains, it, as I remember it, is... It's how it all ends, and it seems unbearably lonely and sad and voluptuous at the same time.
Do what I can, but I think it'd be fake and wrong to pretend to get more mythic or Cheever-esque or complicated. I mean, I just try to listen to whatever creative consciousness I've got and to repeat and rewrite and do the best I can. But I think it might be a mistake for any writer to strive too consciously for profundity. You just have to hope it comes. What makes American family dramas different from European or English family dramas? And it seems to me that in American family dramas, as opposed to Chekhov or as opposed to the English family, there's this tremendous sense of having to measure up, to the dream. That somehow when the family goes, I mean, just you take long but the day's journey into night, the agony of the father for having dissipated his talent by playing the Count of Monte Cristo all his life. The sense of we have created this country and our job is to do something special and that we're supposed to kind of redeem the rest of the world.
After the canvas is stretched and sized, you'll see that I just draw the lines on it. And the lines are guidelines. The line in these paintings is essentially the same as in the stripe paintings. It's a guideline which indicates a kind of blank space, a space between the painted areas, and I paint up to either side of the line, and I essentially follow it. In the stripe paintings, I followed it by eye. In these paintings, since the areas are so big, it seems to me easier to do it with the tape, and I use a fairly cheap grade of tape which bleeds slightly, gives me a slightly irregular edge. A really straight line is not what I want, and I'm happy with the line that I've gotten out of this tape and the way that it's worked out. It seems to me just uneven enough to hold the color and to work as a separation between the colors.
To go by because he's still not up to speed. These restrictor plate motors just cannot get up to speed that quickly. So now five cars up in the lead draft.
After laying on the tape, it's just a matter of choosing the colors, and it seems to me as far as this series of paintings is concerned, it's the only real problem. It's the only thing that I have to do right.
Point in NASCAR Winston Cup competition. That's your Ernie Irvin lead. That's going to be about perfect because that the leaders, there are five cars that are bunched together leading the race. Terry Labonte, Jeff Gordon, Bobby Labonte, Gary Cope, and Kenny Walsh are about to catch a group of slower cars, which could slow them down. Obviously, the best thing to do is become busy. And here comes Terry Labonte. Here comes Jeff Gordon. All five cars going to pit together, trying to stay in the lead together, trying to stay in the group together.
out. You know, I don't know if I'm going to make it this time or not. This stuff has rotted me from the inside out. I mean, it's gone so far as to eat my sex life away. I don't even care to have sex anymore. I mean, it's just, it's taken everything. You know, I don't know where I find this willingness to go through this pain I went through. I don't know where I find it. I don't know what it is. I get to the point where I just say, I can't take this anymore, I gotta try again. And I give it my best shot. Give it my best shot.
The FBI would arrest them, and then CIA would come and spring them. Then I went to technical services, where I was in charge of finding documents that you don't find in libraries, like where you put explosives on a bridge. Where's the best place to put an explosive on a bridge, and what kind of explosive do you have to get that goes underwater without it, you know, destroying its effectiveness? Also, I had to find, one time they wanted me to find out if there was such a thing as a poison that was undetectable, especially one that seemed to mimic a heart attack, that would kill someone, but it would appear that they had a heart attack. I did find such a thing.
Does this pistol fire the dart?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman, and a special one was developed which potentially would be able to enter the target without perception.
The poison was frozen into some sort of dart, and then it was shot at very high speed into the person, so when it reached the person, it would melt inside them, and the only thing would be like one little tiny red dot on their body, which was hard to detect. There wouldn't be a needle left or anything like that in the person.
But also the toxin itself would not appear in the autopsy?
Yes, so that there was no way of perceiving that the target was him.
I think the preference for industrial paint, obviously epoxy for enamel surface, these colors are largely manufactured in what you would call tints. They have a lot of white in them, and the effects that I get would be slightly duller than you can get in something like artist colors like Liquitex. Now, my colors are not going to have the kind of crispness or the kind of intensity, say, of Liquitex or Magna. And why I want this slightly dull finish, or why I prefer these colors, I don't know. It's a question of surface. Thinking about the color abstractly hasn't done me really, say, any good. To solve or analyze color in the way that you might say that I've been able to work more successfully with structure.
limit. The way they do that is check the RPM. In second gear, it should be 4,800 RPM. First man to hit the spots, because he's closer, is Gordon. But Labonte's crew goes to work. Now, Labonte's team will take on four tires. We'll wait to see. Yes, Gordon will as well. So this will be a nominal stop for both teams. No changes are anticipated, Jerry.
All right, four tire changes going on Bobby Labonte's Interstate Battery in Pontiac. They're already on the left side. They just moved to the left side now of the Goodrich Chevrolet for Dale Earnhardt. Bobby Labonte is down and away. Left front tire going on the three car. Left rear. They're getting completely full of fuel, cleaning the windshield, and he is away just behind the 30 car of Derek Brooks.
When do you say enough? Otherwise, it's just yells across the parapet all night long.
Those of you who don't program, maybe you cook. And so, if I explain the same issue regarding recipes, it might be more immediately clear.
Color is obviously a more ambiguous area. It becomes finally for me a matter of preference. I mean, I have to like the color, and I have to feel that it's convincing in some kind of way. The whole thing, the whole painting has to be convincing.
Instead of going to man as the measure of things, or to the model, or going out into nature to paint as the Impressionists did, your generation felt that it must, how would you put it, reconstruct reality, or make
well,
a new kind of art?
Take the elements which are in us, human elements, which our imagination can provide us, and with that build our art.
You know, I'm always looking for, I'll always be looking for like an easy way out, you know, type of thing. I don't know if that's what I'm doing or not. I have hope that there's help somewhere for me, you know, and I hope it's not me just looking for a magic pill.
And they teeter there, sort of adrenaline rush, you know, and all that sort of thing. And then they find their balance, or Jesus comes and saves them, or whatever, and that's ancient. And they carry them off to, you know, heaven, where the angels sing and play their harps, and God sits on the throne with Jesus at his right hand and Mary somewhere around there. And, you know, they stand around, and then, oh, here comes one, and they all get in their... Sit down, put on the crown, come on, get over here. Then you go into the somnambulism, you know, into the somnambulism, and you have a wonderful time. And then you come out of it, and once upon a time you decide, is this all there is? And then they take down the flats, and everybody gets to work, you know. And you... Well, your subconscious mind can be whatever way you want it to be, and it will be. So let it be whatever. You don't have, you can't be wrong here. Whatever you'd like it to be. And if next week you think, that was a dumb choice, I want it to be this way, it'll change. Just...
Obligation as journalists to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, but I think we have to be extremely careful in what we accept as definitions of problems, because when you get issue-oriented media campaigns that are basically constructed on hyperbole, you not only end up misleading the public, but you end up in a situation in which the bodies that respond, Congress, legislatures, whatever, often attack the wrong problems. And then 10 years later, you find out you have a much bigger problem that you hadn't even identified correctly at the time. So I feel that at this point in our experience, we don't have much of an excuse for this. You could say, in 1950, you could say, well, media is not very sophisticated. Most of its reporters are not college graduates. Most of its reporters are not broadly experienced. But we have the best educated media in the world right now. And I'm really looking around to see what that means in terms of describing reality a little more clearly. But
it embarrasses my mother. Some of us in this room may write, and I think I should take a minute to say this to those of you who write. Your mother will always be embarrassed if you do a love poem. And that's because, it's true, that's because she thinks that everybody else will think that they know what you do. Right? And I said to my mother several times, you know, Mother, I'm a writer. I mean, my obligation is to relate to the expanse of things. Mothers don't think like that. She said, I don't want you to read them poems. I said, well, I have a couple of poems. These are my two crazy love poems. I don't know if you've fallen in love to be crazy. I think everybody should. If you haven't, you should just go out and do that. I mean, I think that... No, really, you've missed a lot. I mean, it doesn't last. I mean, that kind of, you know, where are you going to the bathroom? Come right back, you know. See what I mean? That's good for about 72 hours. Then you have to go on and... But it's a nice feeling while you do it. This is one of those crazy kind of poems. And, of course, I know this is a New York audience, unlike, you know, Cedar Rapids or something. So you know that actually this has nothing. This is not autobiographical in any sense of the word. I will say this, though, about all of that. No matter what you do, for those of us who are writers in this room, no matter what happens in your life, be sure to get the poem. You know, yeah, because otherwise, why waste the experience? I mean, you know, you get a... That's true, you get a great poem when... Love, you get a great poem, you get tired of them, you get a great poem when you break up. One of them is bound to be publishable.
Sangranka uruwar kaba, ahmidu umure kaba, mandil simbar alisi di ponte. Thank you.
Those who say, whatever happened to Ally Sheedy?
Right.
You say what?
Whatever happened to me in terms of visibility
and the
rat pack
business,
the media.
And then all of a sudden, the media attention and all that. Did you just drive you nuts and you say, and flee from it, or what?
It was a combination of making things difficult for myself, of having movies that making choices that were not commercial, so I was no longer commercially viable, and of becoming so sickened by Hollywood itself that I had to get out of there. So there were a few factors involved. It wasn't just that I packed up and left, but it's not that there was anybody going, please stay, oh, come back, we're dying. You know?
Okay. Bring me enough.
I think it starts in her in her, she does not have any dishonesty in her at all. She's a photographer and she takes pictures of what she sees, and they are not fixed up in any way, and a lot of them have a certain amount of pain in them. She doesn't lie. She says exactly what she feels, goes after what she wants to go after, and just has no facade. There's a lot of that in me, and it's something that does not always make things easy, and as a matter of fact, gets me into a lot of trouble. But it's something that I treasure and won't give up. And also that her emotions are raw. She's just they're right there, right below the surface, which is why I think she needs to create a kind of a dream world to live in to make things easier for herself.
Is that heroin? Or
that's her heroin world.
And her work, her photography. She's a brilliant photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But where is she in terms of being motivated to make art?
I think that it's much purer than that. I think it's simply something that she was born with, a gift that she loves to do. And I don't think there's anything high-minded in about this is art or this is not art.
This
is what I do.
This is my gift.
And the problem was that she just did it, and suddenly this attention came around it, and I think it made it impossible for her to just simply do her work. And I also think because she's so thin-skinned and there's so much right near the surface that the people in I don't know a lot about the photography and art world, but my analogy is, of course, too, Hollywood and the movie world, just a lot of people coming in and coming at you, and I don't think that she could handle that. And I think it started to get in the way of her, which she loved to do.
Same thing for you.
Very, very close.
And so once you went out to Hollywood and the Brat Pack and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
How did you feel about it? Were you happy about it? Did you look and say, holy, you know, St. Elmo, I know Breakfast Club and I know St. Elmo's has gotten a lot of attention, but is this what it is?
Well,
did you feel
first,
like a band of brothers with all those people? Or?
I did feel like a band of brothers. I felt and sisters.
Non-gender specific.
Yeah. I remember I was filming St. Elmo's Fire when Breakfast Club came out, and I had worked in a movie called Twice in a Lifetime with Gene Hackman and Ellen Burstyn and Anne Margaret. And I was so excited because Breakfast Club came out and it was this big success. And I was at a very, very happy point in my life, and I really felt like these things were happening, and I really loved what I was doing. And I believed at that point that I was going to be able to find the stuff that I wanted to do. I was going to be able to do that. When the Brat Pack article came out in New York Magazine, there was this sort of pall cast on everybody, and it was sort of, I guess I felt like that for the first time I sort of belonged to this group of people, and I had family, and these were my friends, and we were colleagues, and we were all working together, and then it was suddenly disbanded, it felt. Like, nobody wanted to be seen with anybody else, and
just because it would confirm what the magazine article said, that we were somehow...
I guess so. I mean, it was just ridiculous. The truth of the matter is, I've never read the magazine article. I just felt the effects of it, which were, this is turning negative, and everyone wanted to go off in their separate ways and not be associated with anybody else. And I experienced that as a loss, because those were my colleagues. And it was after that happened that I did begin to feel a bit isolated and sort of in over my head. And, I was 23. I mean, it was just too much.
Too much.
It was too much to have handed. It happens like this. It gets handed to you there if you're successful. It's you work hard, and I worked hard, and it comes. And everybody says, isn't it wonderful, and you are wonderful, and here you go. Here's your dream come true. And then something happens where it goes towards the negative somehow, and I'm not really sure what the forces that be are that can make that happen, but then all of a sudden it starts to go away. And I didn't understand if I had done something wrong.
Did you feel it slipping away?
Oh, I could feel it before I could get anybody else to admit to me that it was happening. I said, there's something going wrong. It's going away. I just want to work. I really just want to work, which is also when I started to get into this big brouhaha with all these people, just about realizing that I didn't want to be, it just gradually began to dawn on me that I did not want to be a movie star. Here I was in the middle of Hollywood, and that's what you're supposed to want to be. And I wanted to be Jenna Rollins, and, you know?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so it's really, I mean, that's a different... That path goes like this,
yeah.
And it's uphill, and it's very hard to figure it out.
Who helped you doing all this? Who was there to say, look, you're not making bad choices? I mean, you're less
Harold than Guskin, who's a teacher that I found, who lives in Greenwich Village.
Right.
I've been studying with him for a long time. He's also director. He was the person I called. He was the person I started studying with intensively. Starting in 1987 all the way up until right now. Just spending summer down there, just working.
Study.
Yeah, and I found someone to work with who just... I don't care if I'm... movie star or not, you know, it's always about the work for him. It's about the work and the work and the work.
And you didn't care that you'd been a movie star, you just wanted to get better and better and better, and this was an avenue to get better.
Yeah, because in my mind, I was going to be doing this when I was, like, you know, way down the road and old, just, like, showing up Spencer Tracy. You know what I mean?
I do. But when you would look up there and see these other guys having... more success than you were having. Success. Mm-hmm. Did you say, were you jealous? Were you what?
I felt like, okay, this is really the way to become successful. You have to make yourself into some kind of, I always think that love interest equals actually sex object, okay, to me. That's the real definition of a love interest in the movie. And that's just not me. So, and I didn't want to do it, but I felt like, okay, all the corroboration goes that way. So, it was more of a question of looking and having it continually reinforced for myself and inside myself that there's a different way to go, there's a different kind of actor to be, and I don't have to do that, you know? I don't have to be that. And I don't want to be that.
I think the first time that I seriously questioned anything that was more than I just couldn't take it anymore was when I came across this document. It was eyes only, and it was to my boss, but he only had one hand and a hook in the other hand, so I always opened all of his mail and his packages and so forth. And this one, he wasn't in the office. I opened it and I read it. It said eyes only. I wanted to read it because I wasn't supposed to, probably. And it was a report about a mission where they had blown up a bridge in Asia somewhere, and they had killed a number of women and children who were on their way to market that morning. It was reported as though they were really proud, mission accomplished. That one bothered me a lot.
Described to me as a warm, embracing, hello there, we're your relatives, you're on the way to heaven, come on in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's described to me.
I have hope that there's hope for me somewhere, that there's help for me somewhere.
What's your point?
Expecting too much from it right now?
there are always great expectations, as there have been in other telecommunications technologies. We look back on radio and especially television and imagine what it was going to be. It would bring, you know, wonderful new works and the like. And it did, but it also brought a kind of wasteland of common denominator. The internet may not suffer quite the same syndrome, and the reason is simple. The sources of material are far more diverse in the internet. They're you and me, not just central broadcasting facilities and programming, programming sources from a small number of suppliers. And so in that sense, it is a world of contribution that we get to share.
And when the family goes awry, there's always the sense of the ideal family behind it. I mean, in my play, Children, there's that sense, when they get out the family ledger, there's a sense of decay and a sense of guilt for having betrayed the promise of their ancestors.
They usually don't get enough customer contact. So, but you know, you could imagine doing that with videos.
The next question is, what are the pros and cons of building an internet business outside of Silicon Valley?
Well, I think one of the pros, so there's certainly some cons. It's easier to get a business started in Silicon Valley. I think because it's easier to sort of quickly assemble a team here. Recruiting is probably harder in Seattle than it is in Silicon Valley, just because the numbers of people here are larger, at least in these technical and internet areas. One of the advantages, however, and I think, for example, Microsoft up in Seattle has benefited from this tremendously, is that if you do have an established company, turnover rates tend to be much lower in Seattle. So while it may be harder to get people to join your team, over time, they tend to stay longer. So I think that may be one of the biggest...
Situation at the front of the field right now is Michael Waltrip in the Wood Brothers car. Now, if the caution does come out, how will this mean an advantage for these guys?
Well, there's going to be several cars that are lapped down. It goes back to about the 19th position. Ernie Irvin is still in the lead lap.
Says they are not doing anything. They are just they're just a lot of stupid people who live here. And he knows again, you see, the stupid doesn't mean just straight stupid, but the higher stupidity of being people who are humble and don't have intellectual pride.
I feel that I'm an American painter in the sense that this is where I grew up and lived, was born, and this is where I've developed my ideas and so on. At the same time, I hope that my work transcends the issue of being an American. I recognize that I'm an American because I'm not a Czechoslovak. And my work was not painted in Czechoslovakia or in Hungary or in India. But I hope that my work can be seen and understood on a universal basis.
Of the spirit being crammed into a form, and all the time you say, this is life, and then suddenly there is a release, and there's this expansion that occurs, and there's just extraordinary. So when I asked Emmanuel, I said, what am I doing on earth? Who made this mistake? You know, like, oh, I should be in heaven. I'm very pure. What am I doing with all these gunuffs, with all these, you know, rascals and people like that? He said, Ramdas, you're in a school, why don't you try taking the curriculum? As if that the coming to earth was part of the appropriateness of the way my karma was working out. This was the form through which I would become free. And so instead of pushing against it, I started to listen to how to embrace it. And then you look, when you want to embrace your life as a spiritual practice, rather than pushing it away, you look at the different aspects of your life. You look at the things that the karma has given you. I had my aging father. I had my role as an American, as a Jew, as a male, as a, you know, my role as a liberal, my role as a whatever. I mean, all my history and all of that defined a whole set of games for me. And I listened and I said, what does it mean to fulfill each of these? It doesn't mean to do everything everybody says you're supposed to do in that role. It means to find a way to honor the role, to be it, not push against it, and not grab at it, but to find a way to be in it. And I've been learning that. I mean, like that whole lecture I did about Judaism. Some people said, oh, great, he's come back to being a Jew. Well, that isn't true and it isn't false. I never was not a Jew. At the same moment, it doesn't mean that I am going to do Jewish practices. But it does mean that I am honoring the path. I'm not pushing against it. For years, I was guilty about it and defensive about it and pushing against it. And now I embrace it and see it as beautiful and hear it as a path and love it. And some of the methods become my methods and some of them don't.
We shall hear from you.
came in, I gave him his mail, and I mentioned this, and I said, this is wrong. These women hadn't done anything. These children didn't deserve to die. Why did we do that? And he said, that's the fortunes of war. And I said, but we're not at war. We're certainly not at war in that country. Why did we do that? I don't understand it. And he said, well, you're very young. When you get older, you'll understand those things. Us became addicted to the danger, to the intrigue. It was living a fantasy. It was actually living a fantasy and being on the inside. And it was very hard to leave, even though I felt that they did wrong, and I would never, ever work for an agency like that now. Because I realized that it wasn't because I was a child or I was so young. It was because it was wrong. But at the time, it was really exciting. After that, there was no other job I could have ever again in my life that would be that exciting. I knew that.
Metaphysics. That is, new metaphysics in English translator Mark here
light?
Yeah,
that's why the bright white light is actually the moon. The reason that it's the moon is because the Hebrew word for moon is ima. It means mother and it means moon, but a phonetically equivalent word is ima, which means terror. Christos, of course, which is Jesus Christ or Christos, means anointed, but its original meaning was healing moon man. So the bright white light that was shown, the very terrifying light, is a terrifying story about the moon. Now, what's so terrifying about the moon?
Yeah.
That's the backdrop of our story.
What is so terrifying about the moon?
Well, again, this goes back to portions of Sitchin's reinterpretation of the Sumerian myths that describe the cataclysm of that planet Tiamat, a former planet in our solar system, which was called the Great Goddess, the Mother of Life, and also the Great Dragon. She was split in half in a celestial confrontation with another planet, or this planet's satellites, the planet being Nibiru. When she was split in half, as we all know, or most of us know by now, half of that planet became the asteroid belt circling Mars and Jupiter.
Right.
The other half became Earth. Well, before her destruction, Tiamat had released 11 satellites, 10 very large satellites, one smaller one, our moon. That smaller one was the most important satellite of the whole bunch, because the Sumerians had said that that's the place where our genetic material came from. We were made from the blood of Kingu. And it was upon Kingu that were kept the holy records, the tablets of destiny of this former planet. So the moon emerges, if you use your imagination, as sort of a Death Star, a satellite of Tiamat. And David Hetcher Childress and others have gone into some detail describing how these what can be only described as arcs were created.
Boy.
Lots and lots of advertising. There's more and more home pages that have sponsors. There's online magazines that have more advertisers on them.
Although, of course, that's a high ambition.
What will it do for me?
Where
will it take me? And how will it do what Microsoft Windows does better? Or is the main virtue that it's free?
The main virtue, from my point of view, is that it's free.
I open my computer onto GNOME, and what do I see?
Oh, I don't know exactly. I've only seen a few demos of GNOME. It's being developed mainly by people in Atlanta and some people in Mexico and a few others around the world. And I don't work on it personally. You know, there are thousands of people developing free software now. One interesting thing about free software is that instead of being little groups that are all at odds with each other, in effect, everybody's at least potentially cooperating with everybody else.
You've introduced us to GNU, which is the variation on Unix, an operating system, and GNOME, which would be the graphic face on it that's going to make it accessible to me. What about Linux, which we were talking about radical marketing, the idea of sort of the way the Harley-Davidson people do, or the Grateful Dead did, using your customers, in effect, to sell your product. And somebody called in and said, you got to do a program on Linux. Kind of community of smart software people using a free system.
Tell us about the GNU system. In fact, it's...
But who's Linux?
Linux is actually one very important component of the system. It's the system kernel, which is the program. In any operating system, there is a component which does this job, the kernel. And this program keeps track of which other programs are running and keeps them separate from each other so that they don't step on each other's memory, and arranges to let them all get a share of the time and all read and write files. So
you say
Linux is actually one part of this operating system.
7 to 15 million people, you say, around the world are in on this game already.
Yes.
Free software, using it, adapting it, in some sense, improving it, passing back their innovations to others.
That's right. And now we're moving on. Now that we have a usable operating system, the new thing is to work on applications. You know, things like free word processors, free drawing programs. There's a free program I heard of just recently that's a lot like PowerPoint, I'm told, although I haven't seen it personally. There's free software for sending private mail through encryption, free software for speech recognition and speech generation.
Would you make the case that this is a better seedbed for new programming ideas, a better sort of incubator of the future than the big corporations?
It seems to be that way, and I didn't expect that. This isn't my reason for deciding that I would use nothing but free software. That was purely an ethical reason, a political reason, but it turned out that when a program is free, you can then get hundreds of people helping to improve it, looking for any errors in it and correcting them. And this engine of development turns out to be tremendously efficient in practice. And this, some other people in the community are focusing on this technical, practical advantage. But for me, the real advantage is that I'm allowed to be part of a community. With proprietary software, community is prohibited.
Richard Stallman talks about free software the way the ACLU talks about free speech. It just ought to be free.
CD-ROMs containing installable free operating systems, you can probably find them in most software stores nowadays. Various commercial distributions of these Linux-based variants of the GNU system, you can buy one and install
it
on your PC.
Would it take a revolution to break the hold of copyright on this stuff?
No, actually, the hold of copyright, we're just breaking that by ignoring it. You know, sure, we can't get rid of the copyrights on those proprietary programs, so we just don't use those proprietary programs. We write our own replacements for them.
Hacker's Revenge.
I use free software all the time. I use Bind, I use SendMail, which are things that Richard knows about, you probably haven't heard of. I think that the results of Richard's work are, they make my life possible. Without it, my life would be impossible.
Period in Ecuador, I got involved in all these different types of operations. I was running around here, running around there, working with the police intelligence and military intelligence, falsifying documents as provocations to get people landed in jail, running a surveillance team, which was a team that would follow people around in the streets. They had radio communications with vans. It was very exciting at first.
And you had at 25, 26, 27 years old, you had this sense of power, in which is intoxicating, really, for such a young person.
Coming out of Newton, WZBC. New Metaphysics. Got another chunk of time. Gary Geiserman. Kind of in an energy trough at the moment. I guess in a nutshell, the way to achieve freedom from an addiction is to enjoy the pleasure rather than just pleasure by itself. Every Thursday, 10 to 2,
for a roller skating rink in Washington. Here repeated in the New York Theater Rally of 1965, Pelican includes two skaters and a dancer. Based on motifs which have recurred in his work from the beginning, umbrellas, or here parachutes, wheels, and tires, Pelican somehow evokes Leonardo's flying machine and a whole sequence of bird-like images, playing on the contrast between the grace and agility of the dancer and the athletic mobility of the skaters.
The sturdy commitment of their ancestor. And you get that in Awaken Sing, that from the other end. You get that sense of yearning and a death to make this family work out because they've arrived and they want to fulfill everything that didn't work out in the old country. I don't think in Chekhov there's ever that sense that things could have been and should have been another way. And I don't think there is in any English family drama, which is so restricted by the class situation. But I think in the black family comedy, in the Jewish family comedy, in the WASP family comedy, there's always that sense of ought and always that sense of having to measure up either to a past ideal or a future ideal.
Recreation of an ancient archetype, possibly involving a device or a technology of similar to the way that this would operate.
Well, HARP has its own antennas, that's for sure. We've got pictures of their antenna farm up on the website someplace. It's quite an antenna farm. It's not gold, but there's parts of it that are, I'm sure.
Right, and here's how this relates, is because if we're operating along the premise, as many people are, that we're fulfilling some of those prophecies in the Book of Revelation, one of the primary jobs of this figure, the King of Terror, is to slay the dragon. And it appears that that dragon appears in many forms. I mean, it can appear as an individual or as a group of people and so forth. But it may have something to do instead with not only our ionosphere, but the ancients believed that there was literally a sphere of souls that encapsulate the planet as well. And that this device not only could channel souls into the Earth plane, but it could also lift up that sea or sphere of souls that had a tendency to collapse. See,
yeah, but you're saying that, I know, but you're...
missing in many of the Sumerian texts right now. I feel that the answers are there.
Well, let's be straight on with people, Henry, William. Does this really mean that what you believe, I mean, let's just lay it on the table here, is that the Anunnaki indeed were our creators, and as far as you can see, there is no reference to another creator?
You want it till you find what's comfortable. And as well as finding the place, you need to find a way to get there. And that, again, is up to you. Would you like to have a secret elevator that takes you down to your subconscious? Would you like to have a hole in a tree that you could go into and go down? Would you like a lagoon? Like a lagoon that you have to dive into, swim real deep and through a tunnel and come up in another lagoon? Wow, some people, or a secret passageway, or a secret magic word, or maybe it's that your higher self touches your forehead with the palm of their hand, and you are surrounded in a mist, and then when the mist clears, you're there. Or maybe you do like to be beamed up in that regard, or whatever. Find a way. You figure out what you want it to look like, and how you want to get there. We do recommend that you make getting there fairly easy. I do this, and 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 this. That's great the first few times, but after a while it's going to be, oh, God. Isn't there a shorter way? Yes. Yeah, I'd like to touch the side of my nose and say, Rumpelstiltskin, three times, and be there. Fine. Rumpelstiltskin, three times, and boof, you'll be there. So make it a fair, but make it your way. Imaginatively, your way. And of course, once there, once you have a way to get there, and you are there, with your higher self or counselor at hand, you will find the one in charge, which will be, in a sense, a personification of your subconscious mind.
Bickle. I can't sleep nights.
This porn up there just for that.
Yeah, I know. I tried that.
So what do you do now?
Ride around nights, mostly. Subways, buses. Figure, you know, if I'm going to do that, I might as well get paid for it.
You want to work uptown nights, South Bronx, Harlem?
I work anytime, anywhere.
Will you work Jewish holidays?
Anytime, anywhere.
All right, let me see your chauffeur's license.
Give me one
time. How's your driving record?
It's clean. It's real clean, like my conscience.
Are you going to break my chops? Don't trouble with guys like you coming in and break my chops all the time. If you're going to break my chops, you can take it on the arches right now. You understand?
Sorry, sir. I didn't mean that.
Physical.
Clean.
Age.
26.
Education.
Here, there, you know. Hey,
Harlan! Military record.
Honorable discharge, May 1973.
What, were you in the Army?
Marines.
I was in the Marines, too. So what is it? You need an extra job? Are you moonlighting?
Well, I just want to work long hours. What's moonlighting?
Look, just fill out these forms and check back tomorrow when the ship breaks.
All right, will you step up? Take the car out through 58th Street, please. Because it's crowded on 57.
Hey,
Samuel Fuller's characters were no intellectuals. His was a visceral cinema. Excessive, explosive. He once defined film as a battlefield. Love, hate, action, death. In one word, emotion. Impact was his main concern. Whether he was dealing with the Old West or Cold War America, his images were bursting with violence and sexual energy. In Pick Up on South Street, Richard Widmark is a pickpocket and Jean Peters a prostitute. Here, he inadvertently takes a microfilm which communist agents are trying to smuggle out of the country.
How much is it worth to you?
What are you pushing me for?
You came here to buy it, didn't you?
America's fate is in the hands of two outcasts. She's just a runner who doesn't even know what side she's on, while he's a cynic, willing to do business with all sides.
How much did you bring?
I don't want to talk about it.
A former crime reporter.
How much?
Fuller cultivated the shocks and hyperbole
500.
That tabloids use in their headlines.
You tell that commie I want a big score for that film, and I want it in cash.
Tonight.
What are you talking about?
You tell me. You people are supposed to have all the answers.
Tell you what? I don't...
Come on, drop the act. So you're a red. Who cares? Your money's as good as anybody else's. Now get your stern up those stairs and tell your old lady what I want. I'll do business with a red, but I don't have to believe one.
Playing both ends against the middle, Widmark defied all isms, even patriotism. Writer, director, producer Samuel Fuller's work was a potent antidote to America's complacency during the Cold War. He was the most outspoken of the 50s smugglers. No ideology escaped his scathing irony. American hypocrisy was his constant target.
Seem to be doing much good.
Well, also in terms of describing...
Chicago, I found homicide records from 1880 to 1930, and they were being restored at estate archives, and I couldn't stop reading them. And at the back of each volume was 10, 15 pages of unknown. And when you read them, there were unknown infants who had been killed and abandoned by their parents. Every year, huge numbers of them. And when you see that thing, when you see that kind of a situation occurring in media today, of course your heart goes out, and of course you feel badly, but you have to remember that this is not new. This is not a sign of a new societal decline. There's much less of it.
Absolutely.
Maybe David has more specific information, but from my knowledge of it, those are the people you're talking about when you're talking about children being snatched and harmed.
This is a subject I address briefly in the book, and there was a huge wave of hysteria in the mid-1980s, the sort of missing kid scare. And there are children who are abducted by strangers. It's a terrible thing when it happens. It happened to Adam Walsh's child, who was murdered gruesomely in the early 1980s. But this is very, very rare. The vast bulk, overwhelming bulk of any kind of abductions that people talked about were really parental abductions. They were not, and they were in divorce cases.
Well, why do you think people have this fear of their children aren't safe?
If every milk carton you pick up has the picture of a, quote, missing child, unquote, on the side of it, and if huge billboards all over the road talk about missing children, that creates a perception and a fear in people that may not be realistic. And my question would be, over the long term, what damage is done to your children by having an attitude that they're constantly under threat?
Right, that's what I feel.
When in reality, they may well not be at all. And I think, I mean, when we were kids, of course, this was in the 18th century, it feels like to me now, but when we were kids, we were told basically, don't take candy from strangers, stay away from strangers. And that seemed to work pretty well, you know?
Well, the other harm, or the potential harm, is whether this skewed public policy in some way. I mean, if the real problem was parents taking, stealing their kids in the midst of messy divorces, that's quite a different problem than trying to deal with kind of bands of crazy strangers who were snatching kids off of playgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That after you have seen me trembling a little bit, smiling a little bit, as I am here, you are enlightened more than you were before about my art. Quite the contrary is the truth, and that's the way it ought to be.
You know, in a way, it is unfair to ask you for explanations, because explanations, well, they always destroy things. They destroy poetry. And an explanation turns a poem into prose, and what is lost is the poetry. So in a way it is unfair.
That is, that the language is of a nature that it doesn't have the necessity for its American labels. But all these issues, in the end, whether it's American, or whether it's painterly, or whether it's, are false issues raised by aesthetes. I've expressed myself on this issue many, many years ago, when at a conference between aesthetes and artists, I said to these aesthetes that even if they're right, and even if they can build an aesthetic analysis or an aesthetic system that will explain art or painting or whatever it is, it's of no value, really, because that aesthetics is for me, like ornithology, must be for the birds.
I don't think painters have particularly bright ideas.
What do they?
I guess they're talented at painting things. It's no such a bright idea for Monet to paint those haystacks. Different hours of the day. I mean, when you go to tank group.
A series of women in the late 30s and early 40s seemed to be searching for this way out of the European crisis, or the crisis in art. He was trying to find forms, but instead of finding them in abstractions, like a circle for a clock, he'd find it in an elbow or a shoulder.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Father.
Well, Jim had armed guards. I mean, young men who and women who were told that they needed to watch everybody, and it kept you working hard.
The day consisted of, you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you go to breakfast. You get one bowl of rice. At that time, I think it was rice and milk, is what it was. And the rice and milk consisted sometimes of bugs floating around all on top.
We headed out to the fields, and you vied to go really far out, actually, because you couldn't hear Jim over the loudspeakers.
Jonestown was wired with loudspeakers, and Jim spoke 24 hours a day on it. When he wasn't speaking, the tapes that they'd made of him speaking played on and on and on about the conspiracy against us, about how the United States government was coming in to kill us.
But pulling it, it's an affirmation, and it's really quite unique and remarkable.
In that sense, then, you must be sharing with a great many of the young artists now their resentment at the feeling that they're being captured by the corporate mind. That so many of the people, it isn't really even people anymore who buy art so much as corporations, no. Banks, companies, all that sort of thing. How do you feel about that?
Right. Now, I'll go back to Rembrandt. You see, I have a feeling that the world, it isn't only one of this or the way the world is.